Chapter 4. Here Petropolis met the hills and conquered them. Here the city shelved up and became a vertical borough. Mist had gathered in the deep wells of the Formal, and the rain alarms were ringing. Vast spiral stairways of iron, lidded with tint glass, so they looked like vast models of genetic double helixes, rose out of the vapour into the upper levels. Powerful pendant lamps hung down on rusting chains 3 kilometres long, like shackled stars. They left the Cargo 8 in a pay garage under the West 9 stack and climbed Spiral 5 into the Habs. All the pedestrian screw stairs were bustling with citizens, moving up, moving down. Their combined voices filled the huge misty well like the rustle of gigantic paper sheets. The spirals were stepped streets, broad enough for 20 people to a tread. Hawkers and cook stands had set themselves up on parts of the wider outside curves. Some vendors hung their wares out over the guardrails on long frames so that ascending citizens could admire them from floors below. Gymnasts and acrobats, some of them enhanced with poor-quality mechanical augmetics, twisted, rotated, and swung from scaffold structures suspended off the sides of the staircase, defying the fathomless drop. Kara pulled on Nail's sleeve so she could watch them for a moment. Mathewin waited, glowering with impatience, 2 steps up, the kit bag slung over his shoulder. That had been her life before this, spinning and dancing between the thorny iron bars of the circus arena. She admired the techniques. Taut wire, trip trapeze, solid bar work. The augmetics were cheats, though. 360 differential wrists and auto-lock digits made some of the moves too easy, too safe. She could have done it all, org-free. She peered over the rail into the ghastly void of the sink below. Maybe not with that risk.
Coming, said Nail.
They went up past 2 more level stages, and, with Mathewin leading, they turned left onto a landing, passing under a corroded sign that read Hab West 918. A makeshift trader grotto had clustered itself around the landing stage exit off the stairwell, the way worm feeders gather around an ocean floor black smoker. The grotto thrived on passing trade. It offered contraband, tariff-free low sticks by the carton, reheated pasties of mechanically recovered meat product, low-quality erotica slates, dubious mechware, knock-off copies of small-caliber Urdeshi weapons, cheap clothing, promise bonds.
No thanks, Kara said to a grubby trader who offered her a new ident and a facial resculpt for the price of 3 courses with wine at a Formal B trattoria.
They entered the stack warrens. Rows of hallways, rows of identical doors, rows lined with failing strip lighting that looked like luminous vertebra. Trash littered the hallways. There was a strong smell of stale urine. Mathewin walked ahead, pausing to read off a placard notice listing the addresses of the residents.
Bazarov, 1190, he said.
A sister, we think, Nail said.
The hallway carpet had been worn back to the matting by the constant foot traffic. Many of the wall panels had crumpled or been damaged, and most repairs had made use of cheap blue insulation tape, which gave off a sickening smell of rotten citrus. The doors to some habs stood open, and inside they glimpsed squalor. Hunched hab-wives talking in doorways or just standing, arms folded, looking out blankly into the corridor. Dirty children running from hab to hab. The sound of poorly tuned vox broadcasts, the smells of rancid food, decomposition, grain liquor, toilets. Eyes followed the trio indirectly, but no one approached them. They didn't want the trouble. They were too tired to deal with trouble. But by now, someone would have tipped off whichever clan operated this hab. 1190. The door was open. An ugly, unwashed reek emanated from the hab. The walls just inside the door were shelved, and those shelves laden with bric-a-brac that was so dirty and broken it was impossible to identify individual items. Nail led the way. The interior was semi-derelict. Exposed bunches of electrical trunking bulged like a goiter into the room where the plasterboards of the west wall had collapsed. Garbage covered the floor and the crippled furniture. Two heavy tanks of lead glass with iron frames stood over by the eastern wall, full of filthy brown fluid that bubbled occasionally. The smell came from them. The only real illumination came from an old Pict viewer set in the corner, distorted black-and-white images dancing and flickering on its cracked valve screen. A woman sat watching it. Nail cleared his throat. The woman glanced round and looked them up and down. Then she went back to her viewing. She was old, Kara thought. Not a sister. A mother. A grandmother, even.
"Looking for your brother," Nail said.
"Take your pick," she said, and gestured to the tanks. Kara looked again and saw that inside the glass tanks were pallid, deformed lumps of flesh. Limbless, formless, supported by the filter pipes and the chem pumps. She saw a single, pitiful eye. "Shit!" she recoiled.
"Your other brother," Nail said.
The woman got up and faced them. If she was the sister, life had ridden her hard and worn her out.
"Dreys," Nail said. "It's probably not to your advantage to protect him."
"I won't protect him," she said, somewhat surprisingly. "Knuckhead. He come here earlier, but I sent him away. Way he was acting told me whatever was after him was going to kill him, and anyone what helped him. And I didn't want part of that. Not for me or my brothers."
Mathewin suddenly tensed and turned round. A heavy-set, acid-marked clanster stood in the doorway, looking in at them. Four or five more loomed outside in the hall. Mathewin reached for his weapon, but Nail stopped him with a look.
"You all right, Nenny Bazarov?" asked the clanster.
"Yes," she said.
"You don't want them escorting out?"
"No,"
she said.
"Dreys was always bad news. I won't be sucked down with him. I got my brothers to look after."
"What happened to them?"
Nail asked.
"Metal poisoning. Industrial accident. They got workers' comp, but it's not much. 10 years I cared for them. Can't even afford to flush their tanks as often as I'd like. Dreys never gave me nothing."
She looked at the hammer in the doorway and shook her head. He backed out and left them alone. Then she looked at Nail and thought for a moment, as if summoning up a great measure of courage.
100 crowns,
she said.
"What?"
"For 100, I'll tell you where he is."
Kara looked away. 100 was paltry. Pocket change. Not to the Bazarov sister, though. More than she'd see in a year. She had to pluck up the bravery just to suggest such an extortionate sum. Nail reached into his jacket and counted out 100 from a fold of local currency. The woman's eyes fixed on the fingers and the money. There was a flash, pain or anger, as she realized she could have asked for much more.
"Grace has a friend,"
she said as she took the money.
"Lives upstairs, in the dead lofts, last I heard. West 20, I think."
"I'd like you to be sure," said Nail.
"West 20,
she confirmed.
"Right up there. His name's Odyssey Bogusian. They've known each other since growing up. Neither one good for the other."
"What's this Bogusian to?" asked Kara. The Bazarov woman looked at her, as if only now aware of her.
"Little as possible. He's a waster. Got a serious Gladstone habit, last I saw him. Sometimes does a spot gamping, other times odd labor jobs.
I heard Dreyes talk about Odyssey working at a meat packer's in a freight zone up in K. And sometimes in the circus silos.
Which circus?
The big one. The Carnivora, in formal G.
Thanks, Nail told her. We won't be back. Nail nodded, and Kara and Mathewin followed him out of the hab and left the woman to her flickering picter, an atrophied kin. The vox set bleeped. Frauke was reaching for it, but Kiss pushed past him to get it first. Even just brushing against him made her flesh crawl. Frauke stood back with a false, laconic, after you gesture. Kiss. She heard Nail's voice through the tinny burble of the encryption circuits. The channel was as safe as they could make it. He told her their progress. Ravana, who had heard the vox chime, slid his chair over. She knew he was tense. With the unidentified psyker out there, they couldn't risk switching Frauke off, so the Inquisitor could shadow the team mentally. Circumstances like this were a cruel reminder to Ravana how helpless he really was.
They're going upstairs, she relayed. They think they've got a trace on my guy.
Tell them to be wary and to check in regularly, Ravana's chair speakers whispered tonelessly. Kiss talked to Nail some more and wrote down the details of their destination. Then she hung up the vox horn.
Got a feeling in my bones, she said. They're going to need help.
Wistam, could you prep some weapons for us? Ravana asked. The chair rotated slightly to face Kiss. Patience. I think the factory owner has some vehicles. Go and see if we can borrow or rent one from him. As Frauke knelt down and unclasped one of their equipment cases, Kiss strode away across the factory hall. She was tense, too, and edgy. A sound from above made her start, but it was just the mangy birds up in the skylight, knocking their rotting wings against the glass. She saw the boy, Zael. He was awake, crouching against a rusted loom block, sipping dehyd soup from a plastic bowl. They'd offered him proper rations, even foods from one of the street stands, but it seemed he liked dehyd. He was a sickly little thing. His undergrown body was so strung out by self-inflicted abuse, he probably couldn't take anything more than dilute, freeze-dry broth. He was watching Thonius. The interrogator had set up his portable cogitator set and spliced the data leads into one of the municipal communication conduits. A branch of them ran down the alley beside the hall, and Thonius had used a sniffer to find their voltage and a uni-plug on the end of an extension lead to hack in. The risk of detection was minimal. The whole of the hive was wired up, and given the city's state of decay, there were breaks in the system all over the place. Finding his splice would be like identifying one hole in a fishing net. Anthonius was a fine operator. He had a slew of whisper programs and encryption tools, some of them auto-issue, some of them self-written. Through his spliced link, he was rifling the data blocks of Petropolis for information. The portable cogitator, leather-bound, was the size and shape of a passenger trunk, and so heavy only Nail could carry it any distance without help. Thonius had got it up onto a pair of packing crates, and it now formed a makeshift knee-hole desk. Skeins of wires ran out the back to the junction point with the extension feed. Three more wires ran up into the sockets behind his right ear. The lid of the trunk, which formed the screen, was propped open with a little brass elbow joint. Thonius was typing slowly using the oiled mechanical keyboard.
"How's it going?" she asked as she came up.
He shrugged. An amber rune appeared amongst the screen's rolling data columns, and he tutted, pressing a key.
"Slow. As might be expected of an administrative world, the info systems are vast and well-governed. I have to watch every step for fear of detection as an unauthorized user."
Another amber rune, another sigh, and a tap.
"See? The city data cores are divided into discrete sub-blocks, which means separate encryption protocols and user codes. I've already burned out one decryptor.
I've had to rescribe the Gaiman Reese paradigms from memory.
The stuff you know. Look, we may roll soon to back up Nail. You staying here?
Yes, there's a lot to do. She nodded and walked away. Zale was now watching them both, she noticed. Zale put down his bowl as she walked away. He'd heard most of their exchange and wondered why the foppish man had lied to the woman. Until she'd walked over, he hadn't been working on the cogitator at all. They were high up at the top of West 20. They could hear the wind moaning and the actual fabric of the massive tower creak and give. The rotting hallways were deserted. It was creepy, like being on an abandoned ship at sea. This was the upper realm of the Stairtown Towers, a place called the Dead Lofts, 6 kilometers above sea level. Originally, these levels had been luxury habs and penthouse apartments, but then Stairtown, like so many other boroughs, had fallen into slump. Without maintenance, the summit levels had succumbed to decay. Wind, acid rain, regular fires generated by lightning strikes, vandalism. The rich and beautiful people had moved out years ago. Now the Dead Lofts, the top 6 or 7 floors of every Stairtown stack, were lawless places where the homeless, the poor, the fugitive and the insane claimed their own spaces. And even they did not number many. It was a sparse and inhospitable zone. There were no amenities, no power, no plumbing. Some areas were entirely exposed to the lethal ministry of the rain. Others had lost their tint glass and were traps for murderous radiation and ultraviolet light. Where the window ports were broken, the high alt gales could get strong enough to rip people right out of the tower or rupture them with extremes of atmospheric pressure. It had taken the three of them 2 hours to cross between the Stairtown Towers on foot to West 20, and another whole hour to climb to the loft level. No working lifts. 2 double backs because of blocked access ways. 2 more due to screw stairs that had collapsed from corrosion. They saw only a smattering of life. Ragged vagrants huddled in corners, shadows that darted away as they approached. A naked man clad only in faith paper, his body hideously blotched with acid burns, cooking moss over a candle. A semi-dismantled cleaning servitor, dead except for its left function limb that mindlessly circled a buffing mop in the air. They had to sidestep acid drips from the roof and check the flooring where it had been eaten into soft pulp. Drafts whined down abandoned halls. Nail had drawn his pistol, and the other 2 followed him closely. Kara was especially unnerved by the absence of Ravana. She had to remind herself that back in the old days, with Eisenhorn, she'd happily functioned without a telepathic nursemaid. But she'd become so used to Ravana's presence since then. They'd questioned a few of the inhabitants. Some refused to answer at all, and most that did claimed not to know any Odyssey Burgosian. But one old woman, hunched on a mat in an empty hab, had mumbled a few directions. The windows behind her were cracked and broken, and hard light and cold air streamed in. The back of her head and neck were burned raw. She hadn't moved for a long time. She was eating beetles when they found her. Through those cracked windows, Kara saw the poisoned glare of the sky, the cloud banks, the dropping view through the tower tops towards the vast expanse of the smog-covered city. This was the brightest, lightest place in the whole of Petropolis, pushed up out above the pollution cover. And it was also the most wretched. They followed the instructions she'd lisped through bad teeth, flecked with broken wing cases and leg segments. 2 halls on, they heard music. Kara drew her compact and checked the load. Mathewin put down his kit bag and unfastened it. He pulled the rotator cannon out and settled its bulk over his left shoulder, buckling the support frame around his torso. The weapon was about as long as a man's arm, a counterweighted cluster of ammunition hoppers from which a swathe of 6 aluminium barrels projected. The cannon actually depended from a gyro-balanced armature that extended from the harness frame under his left armpit. Mathewin took off his left glove and revealed the polished chrome augmetic connector that replaced his left hand. He clunked the connector into the receiving socket on the back of the cannon so that it became an extension of his arm, and brought it to life. The auto-loading mechanism clacked and shifted the first of the ammo hoppers into place. The swathe of barrels test-rotated as one, with a metallic whir.
"I'd like to be able to talk to him before you paint the walls with his body," Nail said.
"Just a precaution," Mathewin said.
"In that case, you get to be backstop."
Nail made to walk on, then turned back.
"You kill me or Kara with that bullet hose, Zeph, and we'll come back to haunt you to the end of your friggin' days." "I know what I'm doing, Nail," Mathewin said.
He did. Kara knew that. He really did. In this trio, despite her years of experience, she was the amateur. She'd learned her trade since recruitment as an Ordo auxiliary. These two had both been doing it since they could walk. Bounty men, hunter-killers, so hard-bitten, teeth broke on them. But when Nail offered her point, she felt flattered, even now. Stealth was her thing. She moved like silk, and had a nose for surveillance. Those skills had been why Eisenhorn had chosen her for his retinue in the first place. She led the way, Nail a dozen meters behind her, Mathewin out of sight down the hall. Sunlight blazed down through the skylights, mobile and distorted by the fast motion of passing clouds. She could smell acid. The music was louder now. Thumping. Tinny. It sounded like bootleg pound, the music of the twists. Mutant club sounds were all the rage with younger types. At the end of the hallway, a door was shrouded with opaque plastic sheeting stapled to the jamb. Hard daylight shone out around it. That was where the music was coming from. She thumbed off the safety and edged forward. Handwritten in paint by the doorway were the words, "Get out." Ordinarily, she'd have had Ravenna tell her what was behind the sheeting. Now, she had to sidle close and peer through a slit. A large penthouse chamber, part of a suite. Bare floorboards, bare flakboard walls, huge tint-glass windows through which the sunlight blazed. Kara waved Nail flat against the wall and took a breath. Then she pushed through a gap in the plastic sheeting, her weapon raised, and panned it left and right. There was no one there. A stained mattress roll, some empty wine bottles, drifts of discarded, soiled clothing, a battered old four-speaker tile player covered in club stickers from which the music was raging. There were open doorways to the right and the left. Beside the mattress roll was a polystyre tray full of gladstones. The Bazarov woman had said Burgosian had a habit. The smooth stones, mined on a distant outworld and strictly prohibited, were slightly psych-reactive. Held in the hand or put under the tongue, they produced a warm, blissful sensation. The sense of euphoria and well-being could last days, apparently. They were popular in the twist clubs, down in the undersink. These, strangely, were dusty, as if unused and untouched for weeks. The floor around the bedroll was covered in screwed-up hanks of red tissue paper. Nail came in after her, his heavy pistol up and ready. She pointed to the player to suggest she might turn it off, and he shook his head. He kept watch on the right-hand doorway as she checked the left. A galley kitchen, unlit. It stank. With the power and water cut, it had no function anymore except as a dump for trash. Heaps of discard rubbish and crap rotted in there. Crap roaches scurried in the gloom. She re-emerged and moved towards the window to be out of line of sight from the other door. With Nail covering her, she went through. Another large room, also well lit thanks to the vast expanse of tint glass. This one was also empty. There was a broken toilet stall to the left and another doorway in the right-hand wall. Originally, this had been where the apartment finished. The doorway had been opened through the flakboard partition with a sledgehammer, allowing access to the neighboring apartment. More plastic sheeting covered it. Kara waved Nail in. Immediately, he saw what she'd seen. Someone had used a charcoal or graphite stick to write on the bare walls, the ceiling, and the floor. The markings seemed insane. Some were patterns and geometric designs dividing up the sections of the room. These were annotated by odd, scrawling texts, some of which were written directly onto the walls, others on sheets of paper taped to them. There were drawings, too, men, cherubs, monsters, all primitive but carefully rendered.
"Ninth heaven of truth,"
Nail whispered, tracing a finger along one annotated space.
"The place of atonement, the zone of understanding, the 15th heaven, where men rest from their travails."
Kara looked at him.
"What the frick is this?"
He shook his head and pushed his way, gun raised, through the plastic-covered doorway. Odyssey Burgosian had taken over 19 apartments in the top of the dead lofts. All of them were stripped and almost scrubbed clean, and all linked by holes he'd smashed in the dividing walls. Each one was an annotated diagram of insanity. The markings and writings became more and more complex as they edged their way on. Increasingly, the creator of the markings had used color, wax crayons, to decorate the walls and ceilings and floors. They found discarded lump ends of crayons underfoot, and more scraps of red tissue. By the 10th apartment, the designs had become manic and extraordinary. Fully rendered views of the city in full color, as good as any Limner could have managed. Lifelike faces, unearthly beings that made Kara's skin goose to look at. Intricate captions, rendered in gold leaf and paint, naming such things as the Hall of Sublime Healing, the Domain of the Sane, the 51st Heaven of Lesser Gods, and somewhere new. Some of the murals had blood and body fluids caked into them. Kara and Nail were both on their nerve ends. The music, far behind them, was a distant pulse. They could hear the creaking of the high out wind. In the 19th apartment, they found Odyssey Burgosian. He was naked and hunched up, drawing on a wall. A basket full of broken crayons, paint pots, and mucky brushes lay beside him. He had half covered the room with designs. The contrast between the decorated half and the bare walls was oddly distressing. He didn't look up as they came in. They only knew it was Burgosian because he jumped when Nail said his name. He looked at them. He was young, no more than 25, and his face and neck had nasty burns on them. He covered his face with paint-smudged hands and rolled over in a heap.
"Where's Dreyes Bazarov?" Nail said.
Burgosian moaned and shook his head.
"Harlan!"
Kara called. Nail went over to her, keeping his eye on the trembling man. She pointed at the wall, and Nail looked. This was the drawing Burgosian had been halfway through when they interrupted him. In full color, beautifully captured, was the likeness of Burgosian. Standing over him, half-finished but unmistakable, were the figures of Kara Swole and Harlan Nail.
"Emperor, preserve me,"
Nail whispered. Zef Mathewin decided he had waited long enough. He was about to move when he heard footsteps coming up the hall behind him. Silent, he backed into the shadow of a doorway. A thick-set young man in laborer's clothes walked past him, carrying a pail of hot rice balls and meat sticks and three polystyre caffeines on a preformed tray. He disappeared in through the plastic drapes. Mathewin keyed his voxer.
"Nail, I think Bazarov is coming your way. Want me to intercept?"
"Follow, but hold back. We'll get him."
"Odyssey! Odyssey! I've got lunch!"
the young man called as he walked through the connected, decorated chambers.
"Odyssey! Where are you?"
"Busy,"
said Nail, stepping out of a doorway and aiming his weapon. The young man gasped and yelped and dropped the food pail and the drinks. Kara appeared behind Nail, dragging the whimpering Burgosian by the wrist.
Drays Bazarov?
Nail asked, lowering his gun. The young man clearly saw this as a chance to flee, and turned. Mathewin stood behind him, rotator cannon aimed at his chest. Mathewin hissed.
I'm not Bazarov, the young man implored, looking back at Nail. I'm not. My name is Gerglunt. And that makes you what?
Nail asked.
A friend. Odyssey's friend. Shit, I knew Bazarov would get us into trouble.
He's here?
Nail asked.
3 cups of caffeine, Mathewin noted.
Lunt looked twitchy. Up, said Kara suddenly. She'd heard the creaking of the roof before any of them. Mathewin swept his weapon up to aim at the ceiling.
No,
Nail cried.
I want him alive.
He looked at the skylight.
Boost me, Kara, he said.
You're kidding, right? She answered.
You boost me.
Nail was about to argue.
Wasting time,
Mathewin growled and placed himself under the skylight with his free hand cupped.
Move it and do what you do, he said to Kara.
She used Mathewin's cupped hand as a stirrup for one foot and his shoulder as a shelf for the other. He was rock steady. Nail glared at him. There was no clasp or catch. The light had not been designed to open. But the seals were rotten, and Kara pushed it out of the frame with the heel of her hand. Then she hoisted herself up and threw from Mathewin's shoulder. Nail looked at Mathewin a moment longer.
Guard them,
he said, pointing at the two men, then hurried from the room. Outside it was bitingly cold and painfully bright. The air was thin. Kara edged her way along the roof, testing every step. Years of acid rain had turned the fabric of the roof into a damp, flaking landscape. She put on her glare shades and pulled up her hood. The gables and wings of the roof section projected before her. Behind her was a tower of old comm masts and cable stays, a vertical nest of rusting metal and faded plastics. She looked around. There was no sign of anyone. Maybe it had just been the wind. The world was huge. She could see for many kilometers in every direction, an immense raft of curdled black cloud cover out of which the massive towerheads of Stairtown poked like islands. The sky above the cloud layer was a bright, watery smear. She didn't want to be out here for long, especially if the rain or wind picked up. She could already feel the skin of her face tingling. She fastened the neck of her hood up to her nose. She walked along further, getting nearer to the edge. It was treacherous underfoot. Kara held onto a stay cable for support and saw smoke waft out where her glove clasped the dripping steel. Fumes from acid reaction were also puffing out from under her feet. Over the steady buffeting of the wind, she heard a noise, turned, and almost slipped. Then she realized it was her Voxlink.
What?
Nail's voice sounded like it was coming up from a deep drain.
Are you?
On the frigging roof, she answered.
No, where on the roof?
She looked around, trying to translate the stark roofscape into something he would understand from beneath. It wasn't easy.
Just turn on your locator,
he snapped. Stupid. Obvious. The precariousness of her state had made her forget basics. She was lightheaded. The thin air was making her pant. Kara pulled back the cuff of her jacket and activated the little tracer sewn into the lining.
Got me?
In the dead lofts below, Nail came out of Bergosian's rooms into the hall. There was a rune flashing on the fold-out screen of his compact Auspex.
Yeah,
he called back.
I'm almost under you.
She moved on. The wind was gusting stronger, and it smelled wet and corrosive. There was a flapping, rattling sound, but it turned out to be a series of tatty old mills along the edge of the roof, their vanes spinning as the air moved. 30 meters away to the west, a gaggle of sheenbirds burst up into the air, wings beating, and curled away over the lip of the eaves. They'd been disturbed. Kara saw a figure scrambling along the lower slope of the next roof section, clinging onto a tension cable. Arms out for balance, she paced down the pitch of the roof like it was a high wire, and then leapt down onto the flat top of a ducting box. The bare metal of the box's top dented like a tin drum under her weight and splashed up moisture from the pool gathered there. She saw a smattering of burn holes appear in the strengthened cloth of her leggings. He'd heard her land. She saw him look her way, and then continue on with more animation.
Ninka was going to slip if he wasn't careful.
"Bazarov!" she yelled. It was hard to project her voice over the thump of the wind. He vanished out of sight behind a flue stack. She dropped down off the ducting box and scurried over the coping of the lower wing. Almost at once, she slipped over and began to slither down the hip of the roof. She caught a projecting truss cable and arrested her slide.
"Kara!"
"West of me, about 40 meters!" In the corridor below, Nail broke into a run, calculating her guess on the AllSpec screen. He had to kick open a door that had been locked for decades and pick his way through a dark, stinking apartment, withered by the encroachment of the rain. Through another door, ajar and decayed to the consistency of wet paper, and he was out into a service corridor. It was littered with rusting junk and as dark as the room before it. A derelict servitor, decomposed down to bone and bare metal, decorated the next junction. It was lying on the bonded floor as if prostrate in prayer. Nail turned left, groping now, it was so dark. Slimy tendrils of filth dangled from the ceiling and got in his face. He spat and wiped them away. There was another door. It gave beneath his shoulder. Sunlight, bright and dangerous, streamed down through broken skylights into another corridor. The floor had almost rotted and burned away. He had to step his way onto the exposed cross-members. Below his feet, gnawed holes showed the drop into the darkness of the floors below. Nail paused, legs braced wide between two mouldering joists, and raised his pistol to cover the skylights. The wind was creaking the superstructure, but it sounded like someone was up there. Kara followed her quarry's path along the lower roof, using the tension cable as he had done. By the time she reached the flue stack, her gloves were ruined. She could feel spot burns on her legs from the splashed rainwater. She was out of breath and dizzy. The metal flues, like the pipes of an organ, had been burned almost blue by the climate. She swung around them. The end gable of the roof wing was immediately beneath her. Then the gulf itself, the flank of the tower, dropped away into the cloud cover below. It looked a long way, even to the clouds, much less to the ground itself. There was no sign of Bazarov. Had he slipped and fallen? If he'd managed to scramble around the gable end, using only the rotting fascia as a foothold, he might have made it onto the adjoining roof wing, a wide mansard that abutted the central rise of the tower. Beyond that was a flat roof section fitted with broken skylights. Kara chose her grip and spidered her way around the gable. Mushy pieces of verge boarding came off in her fingers. She leapt the last of the distance onto the edge of the mansard, trying to ignore the prospect of the drop behind her, and ran up it on all fours to the crest. There she slithered down onto the flat section. Her heart was pounding, and her breaths came in rasps. Gun drawn, she reached the skylights and peered down. Nail and the barrel of his gun were looking up at her.
"Damn," she panted. "Didn't he come that way?"
"No sign here."
She looked round.
"I'd have seen him if he'd doubled back. Maybe he did fall off."
"What?"
"Just stay there,"
she said, and circled back away from the skylights. Debris and junk fallen from the inner tower littered the inward part of the flat roof. She picked through it. The pieces of flaking metal siding that were bent and collapsed like fallen window blinds were large enough to conceal a man. In fact, they concealed nothing except pools of slime water and rot. The rising elevation of the inner tower was smooth travertine, streaked with orange stains of corrosion. As she got closer, she realized the stains marked out where iron rungs had been set into the wall. They were loose and unsteady, but they supported her weight. She went up with her gun tucked in her belt. The end of one of the rungs popped out in a puff of flowery mortar. She skipped it, stretched, and pulled herself up onto the next few. The extra exertion made her head swim.
"Kara?"
Nail ached to know what was going on. With his feet braced wide between the joists, there was no way he could launch himself up far enough to get out of the roof lights.
"Kara!"
There was a ledge, 10 meters up, underbraced by eroded architrave. She got up onto it. It was only a meter wide and ran along the face of the tower to the corner. At the head of the rungs, lichen had been scratched and torn away recently. She wasn't the first to make this climb. She went along the ledge to the corner. The turn of the central tower looked out over another jumble of roofs. Bazarov was scrambling over them, into the face of the gale.
"Got him! Southwest! The next wing!" she voxed, and jumped off the ledge.
It was a 5-meter drop, down onto a flat section of coping that ran along between the beehives of 6 air exchanges. Bazarov was still going. He hadn't heard her. She ran down the coping, stepping wide over iron roof ribs, and jumped down again. She was coming up the slope of roof behind him. Stay cables swung loose from stanchion brackets, and the wind moaned through the few strands that remained under tension. He looked back and saw her, then darted left sharply along the line of the roof, his feet slipping on the loose tiles.
"Stay put!" she yelled.
He reached another cluster of air exchanger domes and disappeared from view. She drew her weapon again and edged between the first of the metal beehive casings. She winced as a squall of rain spattered down out of the pale sky. Then she advanced a few meters more, around the next 2 domes. Another flurry of rain. This time she turned her head aside and raised an arm to shield her face. He hit her from behind, slamming into her hard and banging her sideways into the nearest dome. She dropped her shoulders and flinched in time to evade his follow-up punch. His fist cracked hard against the dome's metal. Bazarov squealed with pain. She brought her gun up, but he lashed out blindly and chopped her across the inside of her elbow. At the same moment, her right foot came out from under her on the wet leading. She fell back against the dome again, and he kicked her hard in the belly. She was coughing, spitting, cursing, so winded she couldn't move. Bazarov, bigger and tougher than he'd seen from a distance across the roofscape, reached down and tore the compact from her hand. He moved to aim it at her head, but had to fiddle with the unfamiliar design. She rolled hard, sweeping his legs away with a desperate scissor kick. He crashed over heavily, the gun skidding away down the guttering. They rose together, Kara extending an open palm in time to stop his first punch dead, and a forearm in time to block his second. Bazarov had physical strength, but no combat training, except maybe a diploma in basic brawling. His third strike was a hooking punch that she stepped back out of, turning her backstep into a full rotate that delivered a backward spin kick to his chest. He was thrown back against another of the domes, but came back for more, his eyes bright with fear. She pivoted back on her right foot and, straight-legged, brought her left heel down into his shoulder. The blow broke something and folded him into a heap. She reached over to grab him, but wobbled badly. The effort of subduing him had really made her head spin, and she had idiot stars of nausea dancing across her vision. He put an elbow into the side of her left knee, and Kara folded, hitting her head a glancing blow against the side of the air exchanger as she went down. A blur. Color. Shapes. The smell of blood in her sinuses and the taste of it in her throat. She shook herself. Bazarov was gone. As she was getting to her feet, she heard a sharp cry above the wind. "Bazarov! Bazarov!" He had tried to flee, but the thin air and effort had made him dizzy too. He'd slipped on the edge of the coping and gone over the side, sliding down the hip of a steep catslide roof, almost to the edge. Kara peered over and saw him. A terrified white face looked up at her. His hands were wrapped around a rain spout. His feet were milling in empty air, the sheer drop of Stairtown below him. She couldn't reach him. She leaned out and tried, but knew at once that she was likely to slide right down after him. She looked around and found a broken length of pipe, but it was too short. He squealed again, his hands slipping, acid fumes rising from between his fingers. Kara ran back along the coping and grabbed one of the slack stay cables. It was heavy and awkward and coiled against her grip like it was alive. Grunting with effort, she dragged it back to the edge and spilled it out down the catslide. It writhed open and down, flopping over the gutter near to him with a weighty metal snap. Then she worked it along so it was right beside him. The cable squeaked along the guttering.
"Grab it! Come on!"
He moaned that he couldn't.
"Come on!"
Kara was damned if they were going to lose another source before he could be questioned. Their record during the Petropolis op so far was dismal.
"Grab it!"
With a frantic lunge, Bazarov grabbed the cable. He started to slide again almost at once. Kara cried out with the effort of bracing against the cable. With a shriek, Bazarov went over the edge. Kara cursed aloud, but the cable was still dragging heavy. He hadn't fallen. He was still holding on to the steel line, dangling out of sight. She heaved once, twice, her teeth gritted, her straining hands slipping on the wet cable. He was too heavy. She couldn't... Patience Kiss appeared beside her.
"Where did you come from?" Kara gasped.
"We thought you might need a hand."
"Help me, for Frigg's sake, before he falls!"
Kiss didn't move to take hold of the cable. She just looked down the catslide towards the gutter, her brows furrowing. Kara felt a sudden slack on the line, as if Bazarov's weight had gone. Ninka had fallen after all. But no, he slid into view, hands first, then his face, then his body. He was still gripping the cable, but it was Kiss's telekinesis that was dragging him up. Face down, the whimpering man slithered up the tiled slope like a snail, until he was close enough for them to both grab and pull onto the coping. Kiss stood back, exhaling softly from the effort. Bazarov writhed and moaned at their feet. "Enough," Kara told him, dragging him to his feet. He was shamming. He clawed at her, so she rammed his head against the side of an air dome with enough force to dent the dome's casing. "Enough!" And at last, it was. Suspensers gently humming, the Inquisitor moved through the chambers of Burgosian's dead loft at a slow, frictionless glide, scrutinizing the intricately marked walls 1 centimeter at a time. Frauke walked beside him, smoking another low stick. They looked like sedate visitors at a public gallery. "Important?" Frauke asked. Ravenna's chair speakers responded with a soft, non-vocal click, the equivalent of a pensive human hmm. The chair swiveled round, and the sensors regarded the opposite wall. From deep inside the chair body came the faint whir of recording pictware. "Acts of insanity," Ravenna said at last. "Random scrawls, showing signs of tertiary stage derangement, yet subordered with specific or quasi-specific symbolism. The product of a trance state, I think. An altered state, certainly. No way to tell if there's any consistency to the inscriptions. The maker could be mad, or illuminated beyond the remit of sanity."
"Surely not," Frauke said.
The Vox Ponder's cadences were created only by the generative combinations of artificial speech. There was no inflection to the rise and fall tones, so it was impossible to tell when the Inquisitor was joking.
"I'm joking," Ravenna said. "Probably."
Nail walked into the room behind them.
"They've got him," he reported. "Just dragged him back."
"Then let's talk to them."
"Whiston?"
"If you please."
Frauke stubbed out his smoke and activated his limiter.
"They would not need much breaking. I could tell that as I rolled into the room where Mathewin had them under guard. Their surface thoughts were all but shouting out. Bazarov was dazed and terrified, and Lunt was scared and at a loss to know what was going on. Odyssey Burgosian was a mess of tics and withdrawal spasms. They were frightened enough by the armed members of my team, but the sight of me chilled them into silence. My chair has that effect, I know. Faceless, armored, cold, as unforthcoming as a polished stone block. At first, I didn't even have to ask questions. Lunt's mind was the most open. He was a friend of Burgosian's, and sometimes, like now, stayed with him in the dead lofts when work was thin and he didn't have the cash for flophouse rates. He was a laborer, poorly schooled, but intelligent enough. Bazarov, known to Lunt but not considered a friend, had shown up that morning desperate for a hiding place. He had refused to elaborate, but Lunt thought it likely the authorities were after him. Lunt had advised Burgosian not to take him in. Bazarov was not good news. The pair had found trouble together before. More importantly, Burgosian was in no fit state. For years now he'd slithered from one addiction to the next, spending great swathes of time out of his head. It had been Obscura for a long while, then pills, then Gladstones.
In the last few months, Bogosian had been using Flects, too. A few at first, relying on Gladstones for his base fix, but then more and more. Bogosian had really lost it. He'd forgotten about Gladstones and used Flects every day. That's when the drawing had started. Lunt was worried about his friend. Lunt was no user. A little low, sure, sometimes a puff of Obscura, but nothing hardcore. He wanted his friend clean. Bogosian wasn't taking care of himself. He wasn't eating properly, and he certainly wasn't working enough. Strange thing was that he seemed happy. Blissful most of the time, muttering with delighted but barely comprehensible enthusiasm about the designs he was making. He'd become so obsessed with them. He'd knocked through room after room with a sledgehammer to open up more space to work in. I drifted out of Lunt's mind. Bazarov was tougher-edged, even though his head was still throbbing from the crack Kara had given it. He'd heard about Sonsel, and was running, witless. "You're right to be scared." Bazarov's head snapped up, and he stared at me, blinking. "Everything you tell me now will encourage me to press for leniency in your case. Where do the Flects come from?" I knew he wasn't going to tell me, not just like that. Under verbal interrogation, he'd spin lies for hours until there was nowhere left to go. But the moment I asked him, the answer he didn't want to give came right to the forefront of his mind as he concentrated on not letting it slip. Bazarov was no user either. A line chief at Engine Imperial, he pulled a decent enough wage, but supplemented with black market dealings, usually narcotics. He couldn't afford to use. The Guild Mechanicus kept a tight watch on their franchised workforce, with random urine sampling and blood tests. If he used, he'd lose his job. Likewise, if he dealt at work. But he did a nice little off-book business in his home stack. As a line chief, he knew people, and had plenty of contacts in supplier manufactories and haulage consortiums throughout the city. He had good travel papers, too, which gave him the luxury of free movement. Most of all, he had a lot of old friends like Odyssey Bogosian, who lived and earned in the shadows of the Hive's economy. Bogosian had been Bazarov's line of supply for 3 years, on and off. He could get most things, mainly because he craved them himself. What he got depended on where he was working. Yellowed's and Gladstones, when he packed meat in K, Grinweed, when he gamped the sink markets, though he hadn't done that for a while. The good stuff, like the Flects, came from his links at the circus. I switched my attention away from Bazarov and directed my thoughts towards Odyssey Bogosian. His mind was like rubber. "Odyssey, tell me about the circus." Bogosian blinked and laughed out loud, looking around like a child for the source of the voice. Lunt and Bazarov both looked at him in alarm. There was no tricking Bogosian's mind into the truth the way I had done with Bazarov. There was no guilt or secrecy to trigger, no hidden truths to tease out. His thoughts were a miasma of unfocused light and color. I probed a little deeper. I felt Kiss start as she sensed the tingle of increasing psych in the room. A little pattern of frost flowers bloomed along the window. I went deeper still. Uncomfortable, Kiss walked out into the hall. Blunt as they were, Kara, Mathewin, and Nail could feel it too, their wraithbone markers glowing slightly. They stood back warily. Bazarov and Lunt trembled and tried to distance themselves from Bogosian. He was sitting in the middle of the floor, chuckling to himself. They pulled away towards the kitchen doorway. Behind me, feeling none of it, Frauke lit another low stick and started to hum a tune. "Odyssey." Another laugh, but it was followed by a slight wobble of the lower lip. I extended into his surface consciousness, surprised by the manifold waves of bliss and contentment I found there. His mind was a warm soup, a thick, reassuring, fluid space. "The circus, Odyssey. Tell me about that."
"The circus! The circus! The circus!" he giggled.
This made everyone jump. It was the first thing anyone had said since I had entered the room. Yes, Odyssey. The circus. That's where you get the flex, isn't it?
Yes, yes. On reflection, yes.
He gurgled and started to laugh hard at his own awful joke. He rolled over on the floor and pawed at the air. Who sells them to you, Odyssey? Burgosian snorted.
Dubow,
he cackled.
On reflection, Dubow at the Carvey.
For freak's sake, Odyssey,
Bazarov shouted.
They'll friggin' kill you if you sell them out.
Shut up, Bazarov.
Dubow and the game agents.
Don't, Odyssey,
Bazarov yelled again, moving forward. I had no time for that. I kicked out a little side slap that slammed Bazarov off his feet and back into the kitchen wall. Then I rolled forward until the giggling Burgosian was right in front of me. That's very helpful, Odyssey. What else can you tell me? He started to shake his head, as if he was tiring, like a man who has been on a wild circus ride, which had been fun at the time, but had left him feeling sick. Like a drunk who has drunk too much. I could feel the bitter tang of his nausea rising, the wild disorientation of a mind and body spinning out of control. May the Emperor forgive me, it was delicious. Any extremes of physical experience, even the most unpleasant, are so alien to me that I cherish them. But this was getting worse. It was as if the blissful warm fluid of his thoughts was draining away. Shapes rose out of the liquid like submerged rocks exposed by the tide. The warm light in his head dimmed, and a black dawn rose up around the rim of his mind. Odyssey! The shapes were around me now, twisted, calcified, bone brown, slick with the last of the warm fluid as it spattered and gurgled away. On the floor in front of me, Burgosian was starting to have some sort of seizure. From behind, I heard Nail hiss.
Get out of him! Boss, get the hell out of him!
I realized that I could not. I was sliding forward into the black light landscape of his blighted, burned-out mind. For a moment, it seemed almost comical to me, as if I was perched, not in my suspensor module, but in an old-style non-powered wheelchair, which had been set on a slope, and I was rolling, rolling down, gaining speed, rushing headlong, without hands or feet or brake to stop me. Odyssey, let me go! Burgosian was thrashing around, cracking his head, heels, and elbows against the floor. There was a screaming, but I could no longer tell if it was his physical vocalization or some keening threnody surging across the scorched earth of his thoughtscape. I plunged on, unable to stop. Before me, a vast wasteland of jet cinders and blackened material, twisted, bulbous, shattered, crusted. The sky was domed and full of rushing, splintered cloud. A sun, as red as a bloodshot eye, rose and climbed across the flitting heavens and set again in the space of a single breath. The howling increased. The black landscape cracked open into a stinking abyss. A pit of skulls. Billions of human skulls, every single one tainted by the echo of its own death scream. There were buildings before me. Towers and spires and cyclopean citadels, all ruined, all made of solidified night. A burned city. A murdered hive. Was this Petropolis? Was this the future? I fell between the vast towers and saw their countless windows, row upon row, tier upon tier, deadlights like eye sockets, giving back no reflection, stained by unimaginable ages spent in consuming darkness. Then I was stationary. The howling had stopped. I was alone in the silence, the ruins rising around me, the air heavy with ash and decay. There was broken glass underfoot and... underfoot. Underfoot. I started to shake. I was standing. I was whole. Feet, legs, torso, arms, fingers. I looked down and saw with eyes instead of photoreceptors. The crazed black soil under my naked feet was covered in a myriad shards of broken glass. Imperfectly, like a deranged mosaic, they reflected back my perfection. I saw my face. The face I had once had. Gideon Ravener, young, strong, determined. How I had missed that face. Something was coming. I could hear it behind me. Something heavy. Something fast, skittering and crunching the glass underfoot. Snorting, growling, spitting. I wanted to turn. My remade body refused to move. In the broken reflection of my feet, I saw the hulking, hairy shadow of some great thing loom up behind my shoulder. Teeth flashed. In the last second, the numberless glass fragments showed my reflection change and become true again. My true self, a knotted, bulging sack of scar tissue and old burn smears, the stumps of limbs, the ragged, useless lump of a head, healed up and pink smooth like a badly sewn bag, and entirely helpless in the grip of chaos.